Disc 3. Chapter 9. Radical Sanity. So man's insanity is heaven's sense, and wandering from all mortal reason, man comes at last to that celestial thought, which, to reason, is absurd and frantic, and weal or woe feels then uncompromised, indifferent as his God. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Mary and I have dinner together every Sunday night. Because of our odd schedules, it might be the only time of the week we see each other. She's always off in the city or New London or Groton, and I'm always out and about or sleeping odd hours, so we decided that we'd both make time on Sundays to get together. There are dozens of wonderful restaurants within a half hour's drive, so we always go someplace new and alternate picking up the tab. I always plan on a steak and end up with seafood. Tonight, we're at one of the area yacht clubs. We're sitting at a table outside on the deck, overlooking the marina. I'm working on a lobster, and she's got something like a braised sea bass Florentine. As usual, I have Moby Dick on the brain, and I think Mary is happy to have someone to discuss it with again after so many years without Bill. "So you understand why Ahab is after the whale?" she asks me, well into our discussion. "It's not about revenge?" "No, it's not revenge. Ahab isn't after the whale."
"Ahab isn't after the whale?"
"Nope."
"Captain Ahab isn't hunting Moby Dick?"
"Nope."
"Well, okay. That's quite a statement. What is he hunting?"
"I don't know."
"He doesn't know."
"It doesn't matter."
"But it's not Moby Dick."
"No. Moby Dick is what's in the way. Moby Dick is what needs to be negated. He's just trying to go further. Moby Dick is blocking his way. So, Moby Dick is the enemy."
"And that's one of your two epiphanies about the book?"
"No, that much is pretty clear. Ahab says that Moby Dick is the wall between him and freedom. That's why the whale is white. It's like a blank screen onto which we can project our own obstacle to freedom. The first of my two epiphanies is that Moby Dick is one of the world's great spiritual books, not a whaling tale or a sea adventure, but a spiritual inquiry, and a breathtaking one. Probably foolish to try to rate something like this, but from a practical point of view, I'd say it's the most accurate map of the spiritual terrain ever produced, and, therefore, the most useful spiritual book ever written, and, therefore, the best book, period. Or so my reasoning goes." Mary tilts her head and smiles in mild bemusement. She finishes chewing and lifts her napkin to touch at her lips. She takes a sip of wine and sits quietly for a few moments before speaking.
"Jed, I don't know if you know this or not. Maybe it hasn't occurred to you. But I think it very likely that you wrote the best spiritual book ever written." She holds up a hand to stop me from interrupting. "Please, I don't say this lightly. I know you don't care, and I doubt it will ever be recognized as such. But I don't think it's even a matter of opinion. I don't think any reasonable person who looked at it objectively could say otherwise. Your book is the clearest explanation of the highest subject. That's it right there. The clearest explanation of the highest subject. I'm not a New Age spiritual person or any of that, and I don't think I'll ever make the journey you made. Not in this life, anyway. But because of you, I understand, really, for the first time in my life, for myself, not borrowed from someone else, what's really going on, what life really is, and what it's not." She pauses, and I see that she's getting a little worked up. I really don't see how there could be a better book than yours. Okay, I'm sorry. I'll stop. So now you say that Moby Dick is a great spiritual book. I admit I'm a little skeptical, but I know you're not speaking lightly, and I know you're not going to ask me to believe anything. So I'm very intrigued. But I doubt very sincerely that you will convince me that Moby Dick is the greatest book, spiritual or otherwise, ever written. For me, that position is filled. I turn my attention to my lobster. We eat quietly for a few minutes before she resumes the conversation. So, Moby Dick, you see something there that no one else has? As far as I can tell, yes, I say. There's a key that unlocks Moby Dick. Once you have the key, it becomes a completely different book, a truly great and important book. Many people think it's already a great and important book. Yes, I can't figure that out. The way it's currently interpreted, it's a failure of a book. It doesn't surprise me that the book failed and Melville died in obscurity. If anything, I'm surprised it ever got resurrected. It's wonderful in many respects, but fails at the highest level. So, I shrug, what does that leave? I guess I see what you mean. There's certainly no satisfactory interpretation of Ahab's monomania, which seems to be the central theme of the book. Yes, I've spent the last several weeks looking through commentaries on Moby Dick. I looked through everything in your house. I went to some local libraries and into the city. I've looked at everything on the Internet. I've read, well, skimmed, viewpoints concerning Moby Dick from every imaginable perspective, and none of them seem to acknowledge the fact that they're admiring a false equation, that it doesn't add up. It seems bizarre, but the reality is that Moby Dick only makes sense when interpreted correctly, and, as far as I've been able to discover, no one has done that. As it's commonly interpreted, it's a sad, pathetic story about a psychotic madman who destroys everyone and everything in his sphere of influence for no valid reason. For vengeance on a dumb brute, as Starbucks says, that smote him from blindest instinct. It's interesting to note that 150 years of readers have not seen Melville any more clearly than Starbuck saw Ahab. Many reviewers try to squeeze some great importance from the book, as if they know it's a great classic, so the equation must be right. But it's not. The equation is wrong. It's obviously wrong. The emperor is wearing no clothes. Some critics say it's the story of man pitting himself against fate or God, because those are the biggest things they have names for. The modern-day equivalent of their tragic hero version of Ahab would be a guy who goes into a fast-food restaurant and shoots 30 people because his car got scratched in the parking lot. That's Ahab. To say that Moby Dick is a great book as it's commonly viewed is as ridiculous as defending the restaurant shooter by elevating him to some grand mythic dimension. It's absurd. This is obviously a lot for Mary to take in, and she's too astute to have failed to see her own name listed on my indictment. And yet, you're saying it is a great book. Oh, yes, beyond mere literary greatness. That's what I'm saying. It's been one of the great pleasures of my life to discover this book and its author. Well, don't make me wait. What's this thing you see that everyone has missed? What's this key that unlocks Moby Dick and turns it into a completely different book? Captain Ahab was sane. Saner than sane. Radically sane. She eyes me for a few moments to see if I'm serious. Finally, slowly, she speaks. I've never heard a plausible argument in favor of Ahab's being sane. People have tried, but it always seems like a square peg in a round hole. I can't imagine any interpretation in which Captain Ahab could be perceived as sane. I know, I reply, but I can. I see it perfectly. Moby Dick is like a picture postcard sent to us by Melville. Up until now, everyone thought it was a work of the imagination, a made-up place. But it's not. It's a real picture of a real place, and I recognize it because I've been there. Mary regards me wordlessly. She's starting to look a bit uneasy. Melville's book, with which she has so long been so familiar, which is so much a part of her life and so near her own heart, is starting to look not so familiar, maybe even a little hostile. Herman Melville went off the map, I continue, beyond the known, beyond where it's suspected there's anything beyond. It's not the book people think. It's not even the kind of book people think. Mary's daughter and I were in dancing class together back when we were still leaving teeth under the pillow. We wore white gloves. She was the first girl to whom I ever bowed, and I was the first boy to whom she curtsied. Mary called me her bonny lad back then. Now her bonny lad had grown into something strange and maybe not so bonny, something that could sit across from her on a beautiful evening overlooking the boats in the harbor and tell her she's never really seen the one thing she's looked most closely at. That even now, children grown, husband gone, life winding down, her journey might only be beginning. She's not uneasy because she senses a new beginning, but rather because of the part that must come before beginnings. The cycles of life do not align with the cycles of the body. It can become a whole new world, a whole new life, at any age, but before we can embrace the new, we must release the old. Chapter 10. Whoever you are, holding me now in hand. Walt Whitman. Whoever you are, holding me now in hand, without one thing, all will be useless. I give you fair warning. Before you attempt me further, I am not what you supposed, but far different. Who is he that would become my follower? Who would sign himself a candidate for my affections? The way is suspicious, the result uncertain, perhaps destructive. You would have to give up all else. I alone would expect to be your God, sole and exclusive. Your novitiate would even then be long and exhausting. The whole past theory of your life, and all conformity to the lives around you, would have to be abandoned. Therefore, release me now, before troubling yourself any further. Let go your hand from my shoulders. Put me down and depart on your way. Or else, by stealth in some wood for trial, or back of a rock in the open air, for in any roofed room of a house I emerge not, nor in company, and in libraries I lie as one dumb, a gawk, or unborn, or dead. But just possibly with you on a high hill, first watching lest any person for miles around approach unawares, or possibly with you sailing at sea, or on the beach of the sea, or some quiet island. Here to put your lips upon mine I permit you, with the comrade's long-dwelling kiss, or the new husband's kiss. For I am the new husband, and I am the comrade. Or, if you will, thrusting me beneath your clothing, where I may feel the throbs of your heart or rest upon your hip. Carry me when you go forth over land or sea, for thus merely touching you is enough, is best, and thus touching you would I silently sleep and be carried eternally. But these leaves, conning, you con at peril, for these leaves and me you will not understand. They will elude you at first, and still more afterward. I will certainly elude you. Even while you should think you had unquestionably caught me, behold, already you see I have escaped from you. For it is not for what I have put into it that I have written this book, nor is it by reading it you will acquire it. Nor do those know me best who admire me and vauntingly praise me. Nor will the candidates for my love, unless at most a very few, prove victorious. Nor will my poems do good only. They will do just as much evil, perhaps more. For all is useless without that which you may guess at many times and not hit, that which I hinted at. Therefore release me and depart on your way. Chapter 11. Marquis de Sade. I realize that no contemplative path wants to advertise the cross or the suffering entailed in the crossing over. On the other hand, we must not be naive about this or in any way mislead others. The truth is that getting to the other shore will stretch the human limits to the breaking point, and not once, but again and again. Who can take it? It is not for nothing that the cross is the central Christian symbol. Bernadette Roberts. I doubt that there's any other stage of development that a person can undergo which progresses so rapidly and for so prolonged a period as the one Julie's in now. For as long as it takes, it will never slow down, never pause. As long as there's fuel, the fire rages on. Every day, sometimes every hour, it's a whole new game because the player is a whole new person, simpler, less encumbered, less false, more awake.
Oh, darn, my crisis isn't going well. Boo-hoo for me. My total meltdown isn't going as I'd hoped, so I guess I'll whine and complain like a little brat. What a coward. I'm so ashamed of myself, even though I know this is what it is. No one gets around this. No one has it any easier. This is what it is. What I can't do today, I'll do tomorrow. Small steps, one step at a time, one step at a time. I can only do what I can do. I never, ever thought I could get this far, could get to this point. Every day I go a little further, I get more done, I know less and understand more. I know exactly what it means to be amazed every day by how naive I was the day before. Of course it looks impossible. I shouldn't even look. Why look ahead? Am I trying to break my spirit? Focus. Focus! The next thing is the only thing, and the next thing might kill me anyway. I look at the thing after the next thing, and I see a total impossibility. But the last thing was the thing after the next thing at one time, and now I'm past that. So what the fuck do I know? Nothing. Just do the next thing. The next thing is the only thing.
She has the family golden retriever, Tilly, with her because it's a rule that anyone using the cabin bring her along for companionship and security. She doesn't see many other people. She goes for long walks and can go for miles in the woods without seeing another cabin.
For groceries, she has to drive to a small general store 20 miles away. For anything else, she has a college town within a few hours. For an internet connection, she has to pay for an expensive and unreliable wireless setup. She lives on energy bars, water, and coffee. Her dog eats better than she does.
One thing I know from going through this is who hasn't gone through it. The Pope hasn't gone through this, so who the fuck is he? The Dalai Lama hasn't gone through this, but at least he admits it. I think about all the assholes I've looked up to like gods over the years, and I want to throw up. Teachers, mentors, spiritual guides, all so full of themselves, but none of them came here. None of them went through this. So what are they? Nothing. Imposters. Sad little mouth buckets. I've seen great saints performing miracles, and I was so impressed, it was as if I was in the presence of God. What could I have been thinking? What do I care about saints and miracles? Raise the dead, pull a pony out of your ass, who cares? Pull my finger, I'll give you a miracle. What do miracles have to do with anything? I think about the people I used to look up to as spiritual teachers with all their endless bullshit about higher states of consciousness and divine love, and I'm just stunned. Children selling candy to children. That's all it is. I read your book every day, Jed. You're right. It's all in there. Sometimes I use bibliomancy. I set my question in my mind and open the book, and there's exactly what I needed to find, though I might be slow to see it. You're right. The universe is magic. All magic. I am the universe, and the universe is me, and it's all magic. What's not a miracle? There's nothing that's not it. Not a part of it, a part of me. I just opened your book this way before I started writing this, and the part I opened to is this. I like happiness as much as the next guy, but it's not happiness that sends one in search of truth. It's rabid, feverish, clawing madness to stop being a lie. Regardless of price, come heaven or hell. This isn't about higher consciousness or self-discovery or heaven on earth. This is about blood-caked swords and Buddha's rotting head and self-immolation, and anyone who says otherwise is selling something they don't have. I know you, Jed. I know what you are. I know the part you haven't told. I know where you are and how you got there. Was this what it was like for you? Were you this scared? Were you this totally torn between fear and mania at every moment? Is this how it was for you? Am I doing this right? Will I ever get there? But there is no there, is there? I know what you say in the book about this, that you never really believe you'll emerge from this. But that doesn't mean I will emerge. It's too much. I don't know what's at the other end of this. I think of you, and I read the book, and I cling to the idea that there's something. Jesus Christ. When did I start swearing like this? I sit at my keyboard and I am flooded with intensity, and there are no words strong enough for the realizations I'm trying to formulate. You're right about looking back. I look at what I wrote to you Monday and I'm embarrassed to have been so stupid, so young. And I understand that I'll look back on what I write today the same way, though I can't imagine it now. Can't believe it. I look back to see all the enormous obstacles I have struggled so hard to overcome, and I don't see them. There's nothing there. Did I imagine it all? Is there nothing to all this except thoughts? If so, what are thoughts, really? What is the thinker? Is the thinker just the sum of thoughts with no underlying reality? When the thoughts are gone, what remains? I don't know. I shouldn't be mucking around in questions like that. It's just my mind wandering during a lull. Thank you for the book recommendation. It was perfect. I was so stuck, I thought it was the end. It seems I always think that, but this time was different. It was a huge blockage, and I was sure it wasn't something I could ever destroy. But I have. I just saw right through it. Every step is its own mountain. If you had told me a year ago that the Marquis de Sade would be one of my spiritual teachers, I probably would have slapped you.
There have been a few times when I read her emails and made suggestions, usually just pointing her in the direction of a key to open the door she was currently stuck at. I suggested the energy bars, fearing that she'd live on macaroni and cheese if a better alternative wasn't presented. The de Sade thing had to do with understanding the selfishness that motivates goodness, or something along those lines. She was stuck in that region,
and Desaad's Justine happens to hold an exact key to that lock. Since it's a public domain book that she could download off the internet and scan very quickly for the part she needed, it seemed like a worthwhile thing to suggest, despite the unlikely and spiritually incorrect source. I don't imagine the Marquis de Sade shows up as a solution provider on spiritual bookshelves very often, but you don't get to choose where keys come from. Some you already have, some you have to make, and some you have to go out and find.
I'm starting to see that it's not this and not that. It doesn't matter what side of something you take, of an issue or a debate. If you take a side, you've already lost. It has you, owns you. I don't get this yet, but I'm starting to see. Battles are lost in the same spirit in which they are won, said Whitman, and I'm starting to understand what he means, as if the outcome of a thing is secondary to the fact that you're engaged at the level of the thing. I take it to mean that you're not free of the battle if you're operating at the level of the battle. I don't know, but I know this is how it works. I try to understand the problem, and I keep gnawing at it. I finally get to the point where I understand the question, and somehow that always seems to provide the answer. This isn't like scientific inquiry or like solving an equation where there's a right answer you have to find. This isn't about answering questions or solving problems. It's about destroying them. It's about seeing a question or a problem with perfect clarity, which makes it disappear as if it never was. In this addict is more than just some of my character traits. Everything that makes up my humanity is up here. Every role I've ever played is up here. Every costume I've ever worn. None of it will survive. I see that now. Nothing will survive. What I know, Jed, I know from you, from your words, your book. As you said, it's like walking along a mountain path and suddenly you slip and find yourself hurtling down a muddy slope at breakneck speed, and eventually hurtling down a muddy slope at breakneck speed becomes your reality. That's my reality, hurtling down a muddy slope at breakneck speed. I know it ends, even if I don't believe it, and I know what comes after, even if I can't imagine it. The first step is the last step, and I know I'll never experience firm footing again. The illusion of firm footing, that is. There is no such thing as terra firma, because there's no firma, only incognita.
The passages of Julie's writing we're looking at, in not very particular order, were chosen because they exhibit the process itself, her awareness of it, her constant discovery of it, her relationship to it. The mass of her writings are very specific to her, and not of general interest. She has two main sources of fuel. One is her mother, who has taken on exaggerated proportions in Julie's mind. The other fuel source for much of Julie's hottest burns is the long list of spiritual teachers she has come into contact with over the years and by whom she feels particularly betrayed. She spends many hundreds of pages killing and dissecting various spiritual teachings, seeing what about them drew her and illuminating that thing in herself. However, we're not going to look at the actual contents of her process so much as the process itself. One person's particular set of locks and keys is of less value to observe than the process by which locks are identified and keys located.
I should have understood this from the beginning. Should have understood a lot of things from the beginning. What I thought was going to be merely impossible, I now see would be light years beyond impossible. I entered this conceptual attic assuming it would be something for me to investigate, explore myself, maybe do some cleaning and rearranging. Then I slowly came to realize that I'm not up here to investigate or discover or uncover. I'm not here to clean or rearrange. I'm here to destroy, to remove everything, whatever it takes, to completely empty this space and start from zero. My job is to empty this space, to scrub it down to the walls and floorboards, to let in clear light and clean air, and then, once I have reclaimed this space as mine, then I can, if I wish, if I exist, begin the process of bringing things back in, small things, one at a time, each one carefully selected by me. The irony is that this clutter is me. So who is left when all this garbage is gone? I don't pretend to understand it. But I'm not doing this as a self-improvement exercise. I'm doing this because I must. Because I am not me, so I must die and good riddance. What comes after is hardly a consideration. Only in this way can I ever call this space of me mine. I should have known this from reading your book, Jed. But you can't know something like this from reading. As you say, it's no good seeing the teacher do the math on the board. You have to do the calculations yourself, or else the answers are just words. Now I'm beginning to see something I could never have understood if you had told me 1,000 times. I'm not just up here to clear the space. I'm up here to burn. This attic is to become a furnace, is already becoming a furnace. This is where I burn me. I can already feel the heat. The process has already begun. This is what's happening. As I write these words, I am physically ill. I have been sick with this growing realization for days. I would rather be dead than continue. There is no torture I would not prefer to what I see ahead. I can't go on and will not go on. I thought I could, but I can't. I see things ahead that can't be. Nothing good comes of this. No one benefits. Nothing is improved. Nothing gets better. It's just nothing. What's the point of nothing? I must destroy everything, even the good, even the beautiful. That is the only way to proceed, so I can't proceed. Fine. I'll suffer as a slave, a prisoner of ignorance. I don't care. Who was I to think I could do this? No one could really do this. No woman could. Certainly no mother. What a dreadful, revolting, sickening thing. It's over. I was such a fool. I am sick with myself and wish I could just die and be done with it all.
Every step is a mountain. That's the way of it. Chapter 12. The American Way. The United States themselves are essentially the greatest poem. Walt Whitman. I have been coming around to an amusing realization for several years, but not until the white whale breached for me did it really click into a certainty. Melville's Moby Dick is, to my mind, the capstone of this claim, and the claim is basically this: America kicks spiritual ass. I am confident in saying that the American seeker could do as well or better in his own language and in his own country than he could by searching all of the East and going back to the Buddha. The modern seeker need not feel that the answers he seeks are buried in distant lands, in ancient texts, in foreign tongues. We've produced spirits every bit as courageous and clear-spoken as any found in the East. Although we don't have to, we can now comfortably dispense with India, Japan, China, Tibet, and the rest. All anyone could possibly want is right here, in our own language, and in our own general vicinity of time. This isn't meant in the spirit of an East-West pissing contest. I'm just sharing what I feel is a pretty interesting observation. America is not the spiritual third world. We don't have to become archaeologists of spirit, tramping desperately through the ages and around the world, as if what we seek was only to be found at the furthermost extremes of our reach, or just beyond. Our own time and place provides all we could need. Our own people have made their own journeys and have returned to tell us, in our own language, what they've found. Wherever you go in time or place, the reality of the seeker's situation is always the same, that more is less. Translations are untrustworthy. The spirituality that serves society is not the same that serves the individual. Ego rules the roost, and 99.99% of all the world's so-called wisdom, East and West, is, for the purposes of awakening, about as useful as a glass of warm spit with a hair in it. Tui. Having said that, and so eloquently, I'll limit my case for a superior and original American spirituality to the following. If I could have only the Bible, the Torah, and the Koran, or A Course in Miracles, I'd take the Course. If I could have only Lao Tzu or Thoreau, I'd take Thoreau. If I could have only Rumi or Whitman, I'd take Whitman. If I could have only the Mahabharata or Moby Dick, I'd take Moby Dick. If I could have only the Upanishads and the Dhammapada or Seth, Abraham, and Michael, I'd stick with the channeled guys. If I could have the entire world's mystic literature or the writings of America's explorers of consciousness, Terence McKenna, Stanislav Grof, Michael Harner, Ken Kesey, John Lilly, Tim Leary, et al., I'd take the latter. And finally, at the risk of appearing spiritually correct, if I had to choose only one thing, or could only recommend only one thing, it would be the collected works of Deepak Chopra. My advice to anyone who wants to know the truth is to come and get it. But few who venerate truth conceptually are game for the reality of it. The vast majority of spiritual seekers want sweet dreams, not the annihilation of the dream state. Dr. Chopra has, in his many books, extracted the best that the world's religions and systems of thought have to offer, and distilled it into a comprehensive, lucid expression of subjective reality and our place in it. For those who wish to create more health, wealth, and happiness for self and family, more peace and prosperity for society, and a brighter future for planet and humanity, Dr. Chopra's writings will prove an invaluable and incomparable resource. This list of resources could go on, of course, and certainly deserves to extend beyond America's shores. But the point is to create a shorter list, not a longer one. Less is definitely more when the crowning summit of all wisdom, east or west, is think for yourself and figure out what's true. To those who would argue, correctly, that the teachings of the East offer deeper, richer levels of subtlety and sophistication than the more youthful and boisterous Americans, I'd reply that waking up is a youthful, boisterous business, and that those who seek ever deeper layers of understanding are merely fulfilling ego's agenda of stagnation and self-preservation. I don't want to belabor the American thing here because I'm taking this nationalistic stance half in jest, because in turn I don't see that spirituality and truth have much in common. But if anyone would contend that disincarnate entities can hardly be claimed as American, I'd respond that those particular entities, tellingly perhaps, came through American channels. Similarly, a few of the incarnate entities listed weren't born in America, but they did their important work here, and so it all points to this. Youthful, boisterous America is the spiritual center of the modern world. Herman Melville and Walt Whitman were born 2 months apart and died 73 years later, 6 months apart. That seems quite suggestive, though I don't know of what. Moby Dick isn't a novel, and Leaves of Grass isn't a book of poetry. Whitman and Melville weren't mere authors or philosophers sitting at their desks wondering about the meaning of life, guessing, speculating, constructing elaborate theories. They were rough-hewn, self-determined men, deeply involved with life. Melville went to sea, went whaling, lived in foreign lands among exotic people. Whitman nursed the wounded and dying in Civil War hospitals, caring for men and boys in mortal anguish. Whitman and Melville were pioneers, explorers of uncharted realms, cartographers of reality. They do not fall within the scope or competence of literary critics and reviewers. Whitman wasn't first and foremost a poet. He was a guy trying to make sense of his situation, who devised an unconstrained writing style suited to expressing the journey he had taken, the person he had become, and the world as it appeared to that new man. Melville wasn't first and foremost a novelist. He was a guy who made a journey and told the tale. We can make interesting observations about the characters we meet in Moby Dick, what they might represent, who they might really be. But ultimately, of course, they're all Herman Melville. Here's something Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote after a meeting with Melville. Melville, as he always does, began to reason of providence and futurity, and of everything that lies beyond human ken, and informed me that he had pretty much made up his mind to be annihilated. But still he does not seem to rest in that anticipation, and, I think, will never rest until he gets hold of a definite belief. It is strange how he persists, and has persisted ever since I knew him, and probably long before, in a wandering to and fro over these deserts, as dismal and monotonous as the sandhills amid which we are sitting. He can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, and he is too honest and courageous not to try to do one or the other. If he were a religious man, he would be one of the most truly religious and reverential. He has a very high and noble nature, and better worth immortality than most of us. In The Poet of the Cosmos, a chapter on Whitman in his book Accepting the Universe, John Burroughs says, "Let me say that whatever else leaves of grass may be, it is not poetry, as the world uses that term. It is an inspired utterance, but it does not fall under any of the usual classifications of poetry. Lovers of Whitman no more go to him for poetry than they go to the ocean for the pretty shells and pebbles on the beach. They go to him for contact with his spirit, to be braced and refreshed by his attitude toward life and the universe, for his robust faith, his worldwide sympathies, for the breadth of his outlook, and the wisdom of his utterances." Chapter 13. Curtis on the Rocks. One who has seen his true nature no longer regards life as being full of menace and misery, as most people do. His previously mistaken sense of personal volition and responsibility has disappeared in such freedom and joy that life is now just an amusing spectacle, like a game or a dream, in which he has no real part. Ramesh Balsekar. I'm driving an old Jeep while I'm here. It's faded red with black padded roll bars and interior, and a black soft top that I don't use much. Mary has had the Jeep sitting unused in her garage since Bill died, and told me I should use it. I had a mechanic clean the gas tank and the carb, do some welding repairs on the frame, give it a tune-up, and put on some good used tires, and it runs fine. When Mary saw it all cleaned up and running smoothly, she tried to give it to me. I refused, and we got into one of those dumb, inverted negotiations where everybody's going the wrong way. I finally talked her up to 900, and we shook on it. I had it put in my name and insured, put in a CD player and some speakers, and now it's a pretty cool ride. Now that I had a Jeep, I felt like I had to do something Jeepy, which around here means something on the beach. I decided a nice sunset viewing at the shoreline somewhere would be good. I asked Curtis if he's up for it, because he doesn't seem like someone who stops to smell the roses very often. I want to spend some time with Curtis so we can get to understand each other a bit better. I want him to have a better sense of the things he's working on for me. And to do that, I need a better sense of him. He asks his mom, and she agrees. I ask her if it's okay for her son to have a beer or two if he wants, and she says okay. She seems pleased to have an adult male taking an interest in her son, since he doesn't have a father in his life. I don't have much in the way of the fatherly about me, but I reckon it's first do no harm like anything else. We drive out to Montauk, where there's a rock-lined alcove on the ocean I had already scouted out. Obviously a popular site for clam bakes and beach parties. We drive down onto the beach and set up the cooler, chairs, firewood, and so forth. Then we have some fun with the Jeep in the sand. Curtis doesn't know how to drive a stick, so we get started on that learning curve. No better way to learn than in an old Jeep with roll bars and nothing to hit but drift fence and horseshoe crab shells. He's a fast learner and thinks driving in the surf is the funnest thing he's ever done. We do that until the sun starts dropping. Then we park it by our freshly arranged fire pit and settle in. We have a good imported beer on ice, and I brought some pricey Honduran cigars, because it seems necessary when you're sitting around a fire on a beach on a starry night, talking about big things, drinking expensive beer, that you have some good cigars. I don't drink or smoke much, but there are times for it, and it's no fun not to do it right. Once we have everything arranged, we settle into low-slung beach chairs near the fire pit, facing the ocean and the darkening sky like theater-goers attending the time and space show in the amphitheater of forever. We get the fire going and let it settle into a low blaze that doesn't interfere with our view. The sun setting behind us stretches our shadows down to the water. We chat about nothing for a while, sipping beer, watching boats and birds, waiting for the moon to show up. I lean my head back and fall into a light doze. I ask Curtis a few slow-pitch questions about himself, and he's happy to talk. He coaches youth soccer and tells me about that. His other sport is tennis, and he's gone to the Open for the last 4 years. He talks about his family a bit, and after a while he tells me about his brother's violent death and the ordeal his mother went through to get him and his sister away from a place where such terrible things weren't uncommon. I mostly listen, my gaze settled somewhere on the distant blend of sea and sky. Curtis wants to know the same things everyone who has suffered tragedy wants to know. Why evil? Why ugliness and suffering? Why should pointless horror ransack our lives? His questions are fine. They're the ones that slapped Prince Siddhartha out of lethargy, and probably many others. They're good questions to ask as you sit by a fire in the sand, gazing out at the ocean and into space. I could answer his questions 100 different ways for the next 100 hours, but it wouldn't do him any good. The answer is never the answer. It's not that I know the answers, and Curtis doesn't. It's that I don't know the questions, and he does. I see that the questions that haunt Curtis's mind have no reality outside of it. We want to ask questions and get answers. And when people ask us questions, we want to give them answers. But there's only one true answer, and it lies at the exact center of the question.
I could tell Curtis that there is no good and evil, only unity and the dream of non-unity, of separateness, and that the false sense of separateness is ego, and that ego is all there is of evil in the world, that dissonance is born of ignorance and appears as good and evil. Curtis insists that he has seen evil. He's sure of it. I could tell him that most of what he calls evil is fear, and that most of what he calls goodness is also fear. He tells me that his mother is good. I agree, and tell him that his mother is something more than good. She's an adult human being, which is a surprisingly rare thing. He says his grandma is a strict, God-fearing woman and is also good. But I can tell her age from his words as he talks about her. I talk a little about true age and human development and how his grandma is still a child, just a very experienced one, although her daughter, Curtis's mother, is an adult. I talk about these things in a deliberately impersonal tone so as to avoid giving offense. Curtis doesn't seem offended that I've called his grandma a child, which is a good sign. He has trouble with the distinction, though, so we talk about other people, people we both know of, politicians and entertainers and athletes, and what it really means to be an adult and what it really means to operate at the level of fear and apartness. He has difficulty believing that presidents and movie stars and billionaires could be children, while a single black mother who scrubs floors for a living is an adult. "Someday it will be the other way for you," I tell him. "Someday you'll see an adult in a position of power or influence, and you'll wonder how it happened." He asks me if that's what the Bible means when it says the meek shall inherit the earth, and I say that I haven't thought about it before, but it sounds right. Meek is a crappy word to describe someone who has surrendered to divine will, but it's no time to get tangled in clunky terminology. He sits quietly, trying to wrap his mind around the things we're discussing and see how they apply in his life. Most of what Curtis knows about spiritual stuff comes from his grandma and his church and his Christian upbringing. He seems to think of religion, philosophy, and spirituality as one big thing, so that the pastor at his church and his grandma and me are all playing for the same team. He's never ventured beyond Christianity because he's never had a reason to. He doesn't have any questions that Christianity doesn't seem to satisfy, so he hasn't strayed from the fold in search of better answers. But now he's here with me, which is, on the face of it, so unlikely that I have to assume he's going to be coming hard about soon, or already is. We talk through the night, most of the conversation revolving around ego release stuff and how the things he's learned apply to what he's learning now. Like many people I've spoken to over the last few years, Curtis wants to translate everything into Christian terms. This is always awkward for me, so I tend to be less responsive, only providing answers where clear answers exist. Curtis has never taken time to do anything like this before, just sit back and relax and take a good look at where he was and what he was a part of. I would guess that the structure of his life has been pretty confining so far, but these surroundings are the most conducive imaginable to the process of expansion. We agree that we can talk about things just for understanding. That Curtis wants to know what I think and what all the emails and the book are about. He doesn't want to be sold or convinced. He just wants to understand. I think I doze off for a few minutes. When Curtis speaks, I open my eyes, and now the moon is up,
The birds are down, and the boats are in.
Then what about sin and original sin and all that? You saying there ain't none of that?
I rub my eyes and try to remember where the conversation was and how it got there. Then I wonder if I'm saying there ain't none of that, or if it translates into something worth talking about. As I often do, I answer out of my own curiosity, to see where this line of inquiry will take us. There's only one sin, I tell him. The only sin is ignorance. Ignorance is sin. Sin is ignorance. There's nothing else.
Ignorance of what?
It's not that kind of ignorance. It's not the kind where you don't know something. It's the kind where you do know something that's not true.
That sounds backward, he says.
Yeah, I agree.
Then what about heaven and hell?
He asks. I make a voila gesture with both hands. Here it is. More heaven at the moment, I'd say.
And hell?
What was it like when your brother was killed? He spends a minute with that thought before continuing.
And how about redemption? There's got to be redemption, right?
The only sin is ignorance, and all this, life, is heaven and hell, right? Like here and now?
Pretty much.
Then you're in heaven or hell right now? In life?
I suppose.
Not later. Not in the future. Not when you're dead.
I don't know anything about later, future, and dead.
Huh.
A long pause.
So then, how do you get out? How do you get redemption for your sin of ignorance and get out of hell into heaven?
Curtis has obviously been in some serious conversations before. He seems to have an entire operations manual in his head. I've redefined a part, and he wants to know how that redefines the whole. I decide to answer his question in a fairly complete way to see what he does with it. The fire has burned down to glowing embers. A salty breeze is blowing in. The moon is high, and I'm too comfortable to reach for another beer. Ignorance isn't a sin like something you pay for later, but like something you pay for now, I explain quietly, as if talking to the waves. The price of ignorance is living in ignorance, just as the price of huddling in cold, damp shadows is living in cold, damp shadows. Step out of the shadows and into the warm sunlight, and the sin, so to speak, is instantly forgiven. Your world instantly becomes one of radiant warmth and light, and the cold, damp shadows are forgotten. Karma is the same.
Heard of karma?
I've heard of it, he says.
It's like sin. It's reckoned a sort of debt.
It builds up, like you gotta pay?
Yeah, burn it off. The only way to burn karma is to burn ignorance, which is the same as burning self, because ignorance and self are the same thing. Ignorance isn't an aspect of self. It's the essence of self. It's not nothing where there should be something. It's the delicate weaving of something from nothing.
That nothingness woven into somethingness is what you call reality. The part you call you is ego.
Please wait, he says.
Okay.
Ego is what?
The false self. The personality. Everything you think of as you. Everything that makes you different from everything that's not you.
And the false self is bad?
No,
it's false.
False isn't bad?
Nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. I paraphrase Hamlet.
And so things like heaven and hell and karma, which is like payback for sin, right? So all this isn't like something by itself, but something you get because you got a false personality?
Kind of.
Because the false self comes
From ignorance? Yes. The false self is ignorance. Everything that tells you that you are separate from everything else is false. I'm not separate from everything else? No. There's only one thing. What it is what you are. Everything that tells you otherwise is your own personal false interpretation. That's ego. That's you. And that's what ignorance and sin and evil really are. After a few minutes of silence, he asks for an example. I think about it. It's like you're a ghost wearing a man suit, complaining about the rain. The rain is making you miserable, so you call the rain evil. But rain isn't evil. It's just rain. The rain isn't the problem. The problem is that you're wearing a man suit. Take off the man suit, and the problem is gone. Another silent minute passes. But then I don't get the good stuff about the man suit either. That's right. And it's not just that I'm wearing the man suit. It's like that's what I think I am, like I forgot I was really a ghost. Yes. So the rain's not the problem. Right. It's not the rain that's the problem. It's the thing that gets rained on. The common understanding of sin is that it's okay to wear the man suit, but not okay to get rained on. So the real sin isn't all the things about the man suit, but the man suit itself. Thinking you are the man suit, forgetting you're a ghost. Yes. Okay, hold on a minute, please. I wait. I appreciate the effort Curtis is bringing to this. Conversations about important stuff work differently from conversations about regular stuff. You have to stop to define terms a lot, and people want time to sit with new ideas to get the hang of them. A conversation with someone who is brave and receptive is slower because they're working harder. They ask more questions and need more time. This stuff is coming at Curtis from far afield, and he's being very respectful of views that are in conflict with his own by making such an effort. Okay, go ahead, he says about 10 minutes later. I forget where we are. Karma, hell, ghosts and rain. Karma and hell and suffering aren't things in their own right, but disturbances in this flimsy substance of false self. The problem isn't in the disturbing things, but in the thing disturbed. The thing disturbed is the false thing, and if it weren't there, there'd be nothing to be disturbed. Nothing to get pierced or burned or dried out. Nothing to be wounded or slain. Nothing to be wounded or slain, he repeats. In truth, there is no book wherein our records are kept. There are no karmic ribbons that need to be burned. There is no one sitting in judgment. There is only what we think is true, and whatever happiness or suffering arises from that belief. The self is false, and it is the self that carries the burden of its own ignorance, that suffers or is happy, that is subject to external non-self forces. The belief in the reality of the false self is the origin of all suffering and all happiness. There's no one sitting in judgment? What you really are is all there really is. Who's to judge? I don't see how that can make any sense. I know. You don't have to make sense of it all. I was just hoping to give you some idea of what's going on in those emails and stuff. Okay. It's interesting. I like it. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just don't see how it can be. How self and sin is the same. And ignorance. How there's only one thing. It's confusing. It's confusing because the lines are blurred. These lines always seem to be blurred. It's my fault for introducing truth into the conversation. Truth is irrelevant. We're covering too much ground because we're at cross purposes. I want to touch on the truth stuff because that's what he's seeing a lot of when he's working for me. He wants to know about the stuff that's of practical value in his own life, the stuff that can help him grow into a person like his mother instead of his grandmother. That's what I want too, really. So I should leave the truth stuff out and let him get an unobscured view of fun, important topics like selflessness, surrender, living with free access to the observer mode, releasing the tiller, and all that. On the other hand, I don't choose my words, and I'm as curious about this conversation as Curtis is. He's not a computer that needs to be fed with precise information, and no harm is done by dumping it all on him at once and letting him do the work of sorting it all out over time. Time is the ripening agent. The night goes on. Conversations that can be read in 2 minutes take an hour. We both phase in and out. Clouds thread their way across the sky, but it stays mostly clear and starry. We spend a lot of time discussing the age thing, how humans who look like adults are usually just overripe children. Curtis likes this subject because he immediately recognizes the distinction in his own life between his mother and his grandmother. It's personal to him, something he has a direct experience of, unlike the false self stuff which leaves one without anything to cling to or with. "I want to be that," says Curtis when the difference between adult and child becomes more clear in his mind. I'm pleased that he sees the distinction, but not surprised by his choice. Anyone capable of seeing the distinction would make the same choice, intellectually, at least. No one wants to be small and petty and fearful. We're enslaved by our own fear and ignorance, two sides of the same coin. When we remove the blinders of ignorance, wrong knowing, we'll see where we can be, and that's where we'll want to be. But saying, "I want to be that," doesn't make you that, or we'd all be chic, fabulous, and live forever. Desire and the manifestation of desire isn't a crapshoot. It's an art and a science, and it's something you can pay attention to and learn about and get better at. But it's not something you can dictate. You can't reduce it down to your size. You have to expand into it. And to do that, you have to slice away the bindings that restrict such expansion. It's available to all, our natural birthright, and it works in us to the exact degree that we don't work against it, a degree that changes in everyone from minute to minute. If Curtis really wants this, it will really occur. But the kind of wanting required is the kind that starts in the mind and moves to the heart and then reaches out from the center. It takes time, and it can be as much a pull toward one thing as a push from another. "This is what my life has to be, I guess," says Curtis. "I can't see that anything else really comes before it. Thank you for showing me this." I operate my daily life at the level of patterns, not details, and I watch with bemused curiosity when the black son of a cleaning lady finds his way out of poverty and violence into an area of affluence and further into private dialogue with a being as rare as the being I am. There are no accidents, but there are gentle nudges and shoulder taps by an unseen hand. Why Curtis is here and what will become of him doesn't matter to me. However he got here, he's here. Whatever level he's at, he'll soon be at the next. He's going to step into adulthood. He sees what it is and what it means not to be an adult, so he'll make that transition. He'll make it by first seeing that there is such a transition to make. That which he presently considers normal and good is abnormal and bad, which he's beginning to do now. Then, through a death and rebirth process, the bindings of ego will start to itch, and the itch will start to annoy him more and more, until it's like he's allergic to his own skin. And at last he'll shed his false skin and be as if born anew into a world in which he knows he belongs, in which he is not a trespasser or debtor, which is his, and which is not other than him. And that's where life begins, where learning begins, where adulthood begins. Thus are we cast out of the garden, and thus do we regain it. Once regained, we can begin to explore our true relationship with our world and its relationship to us, and we learn that all there really is consciousness and energy, that they're the same thing, and what they really are is what we really are, which is just another way of saying life is but a dream. It's the distinction between self and self, between lower self and higher self. Lower self is petty and fearful and grating. Higher self is open and easy and in tune with all rather than just itself. Higher self is not the same as truth realization, but just in case there's any question in your mind, it's the one you want. No one wants truth realization. It can't be wanted. Higher self, however, can be wanted and can be had, and is, in fact, what all seekers of all times and all places have, knowingly or not, truly sought. Except for a brief description of Sunnaya, who personifies the non-egoic state in its full expression, I swung wide of this topic in Damnedest. That was a book about spiritual enlightenment, which I interpret as meaning the supreme state. Higher self is not truth or truth-related. It exists wholly within the dream state and contains, unlike the black-and-white truth, countless shades of gray. Truth realization, abiding non-dual awareness, spiritual enlightenment, these terms apply to the supreme state. Supreme, as in ultimate, beyondless. Higher self is not the supreme state. It's the natural state. To have money and adoration and power is less than nothing compared to residing in the state of human adulthood. And so a lowly cleaning woman can be a regal being, while a rich, beautiful movie star can be a peasant. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Camels can't pass through the eyes of needles. The meek shall inherit the earth, and so on. Once unshackled from the life-sucking demands of ego, we clearly see the unformed creatures we had hitherto been, like children. Not children in the happy, lyrical sense, but in the abrasive, self-absorbed, discordant sense. What we consider bright and beautiful in children is the inherent nature of the fully developed human. Our true state is one of playfulness, innocence, lack of guile, unboundedness of spirit, robust health and inner light, a natural confidence and unerring sense of right, imperturbability, grace, a calm eye, and easy good humor, balance, freedom from malice and pettiness, the absence of fear, the presence of largesse, and a permeating sense of gratitude. Creativity, connectedness, correctness, this is the clear and rightful state of the human being. One must die of the flesh to be born of the spirit. One's life energy, formerly squandered by ego, can then be turned to the higher purposes and potentials of life in the magnificent amusement park of duality. We both fall asleep in our chairs. When I awake, the fire is down to ash-covered coals, and the first light of the new day is just starting to warm the air. I go to the water to stretch and write my name in the sand, and when I return to my chair, Curtis is awake and watching the first rays of the sun coming up over the Atlantic Ocean. I remove some apples, grapes, pears, gorp, and bottled water from the cooler and set them between us. We eat and watch the sunrise. End of Disc 3.